I said that I don't intend to give you a sermon on stewardship, but I do think we need to put into context the real steward responsibility that you have relative to your particular life program. It was interesting to me in picking up the latest issue of the Lutheran Witness that a Pastor Otto, and I would assume it was not E.J. Otto sitting here, it's Marvin D., I believe, said that he wanted to coin a new word and called it in grace. And that caught my eye. And then as reading that article, and you may not have seen the issue yet because we just got it down at the office, I believe, Friday. And in there, he says, and I'd like to quote, well, what he does, first of all, is he says, you know, we can take any of the English words, the nouns, and make them verbs by some prefix. So he uses the word in grace. And in there, and I quote, we can also encourage the stewardship life by saying, when God engraces us, he does not demand repayment, only loving responses. And I'd like to stick with that kind of theme, loving responses, today, and look at the stewardship of the Pastor's Life program. I'm not so sure, at least I don't get the impression that in many cases you view, or most pastors, and I'll even include teachers in the Missouri Synod, face some of these issues in, quote, loving responses, end of quote. I think it's more a chore most of the time than it is a loving response. And I don't know where to really attach some root to that problem, but maybe it goes all the way back to the Levites when they were not to care about the planting, et cetera, and so forth, and they were to be about the business of religion, and the church would take care of them. I don't know whether that's the beginning or not, but somehow, over the years, I think that concept, and I'm not at all speaking negatively about it, is that, you know, you do, relative to time, talent, in most instances, you're spending 150% of your time doing that, and I think it is the responsibility of the church to provide so that you can do that to your fullest extent. But I do feel that sometimes that creates an attitude of a lack of response to sometime your own personal stewardship life program, and that may be some of the things we can talk about today just in a general way. As I said, I think I'm going to stay with the treasure end of, if you will, and I'm going to deal with it in a planning sense rather than get into the time and talents, etc., as well as not get into other aspects of your life program that I'm assuming that the prior speaker and the subsequent speaker will also deal with. Let me give you a little example to set a stage for one part that I want to talk about, and that is, let's assume that you know an individual, let's say in your congregation, middle-aged individual that has just been really a example that you think has been doing everything right. He spends a lot of time serving his Lord in various committees. He's been successful in business. You know that he's tithing, and everything from what we call stewardship, from that point of view, he really is ideal. And then he dies. And then you find out that the business that he was in, part ownership, was in his name, had a lot of items that he left unattended to by virtue of the fact that he did not make provision for the transfer of the real life values that he had over to succeeding individuals, spouse, children, partners in business perhaps, etc. Yes, I'm talking about the making of a will. In too many instances, I think we don't give attention to that particular aspect of our responsibility, and or we hear from other individuals it's not necessary to do so. I have all my property in joint ownership. When I die, it will pass to my spouse. What happens if both of you happen to die simultaneously? Then what? Those of you that have made a will, you're to be commended. Those of you that have not, I hope you give serious consideration to it. It's just not an easy matter to say that joint ownership will take care of the matter. Also be aware that state laws vary, and what's true here in Missouri is not true in Illinois or in Kansas or wherever. There are different state laws, so anybody giving you advice, short of an attorney practicing in the state and knowing those particular state laws, probably is not giving you good and straight facts. A will is a written direction controlling the disposition of property at death. And you may say, well, you know, the little bit that I have, I really don't need to worry about it. I have a folder here from the state of Missouri that shows what happens if death occurs, and let's say there are no children, a spouse, and just brothers and sisters and so forth. If you own property in your name, not in joint name now, but in your name, and you die without a will, that property will be divided between your spouse and parents, brothers, sisters, or their descendants. What you had hoped, I'm sure, is not for that to happen. So be aware of what really takes place if you do not have a will, and take care of the proper disposition of property that you have. It'll cost you probably $50 to have a will made. I'm sure that no attorney would charge much more than that, particularly to you. And for that amount, you really can have some peace of mind relative to distribution of the property that you own. Keep that thought in mind relative to what you want to do with your property. Make sure that it happens. It's said that where there's a will, there's relatives, and I guess that begins to say some of what can happen when certain items are available at death to be distributed and they're not given good direction relative to what you really wanted. If the children begin to argue over it, are you creating a situation that you really had no idea could develop? One other point relative to that. Don't take the step of signing property over to other individuals prior to your death. Every attorney that I've talked to says, keep control of all of your assets, whatever they may be, as long as you can, so that you know what to do with them while you still have the ability to direct them. I can give you an example, and if I didn't see it, I wouldn't believe it, and you may doubt it. Next door to my folks lived an elderly couple, and until after the death of the husband, you don't realize what, you know, they did or anything else. But we found out later that they felt it was wise to transfer that house from their name over to the daughter. And upon the man's death, it really became the daughter's property then. It was even prior to that. But at that time, she decides that it would be better for her and her son to move into that house and not have to keep her house and share it with her mother. Unfortunately, it was decided by the daughter that mother could have a room in the basement, take care of herself that way, and her and the son would be better off living upstairs. I can hear a lot of people saying, my daughter wouldn't do that to me. And I say that too. I pray God my daughters wouldn't do that to me. But I also am not going to transfer my property to my daughters until perhaps I really do not have the capacity to take care of my own property. Don't take that shortcut. and have something like that end up or create a problem like that. As I said, if I didn't see it, I wouldn't believe it. But it does happen, and I don't need to tell you how that woman feels living in that basement. She doesn't say much to the daughter, but I can assure you my folks hear a lot about it. I said earlier that I really was pleased that most of you brought your spouses. I think it's important that there be a high degree of corporate planning taking place in your particular lives. What do I mean by corporate planning? I mean between husband and wife. In too many instances, I think it is just one or the other of the partners that takes care of most of the financial matters. May be true in your case, it is in mine to a degree, that most of the finances is handled by my wife. Okay, that may not be too bad, because statistically, it's highly probable that she will outlive me. Conversely, though, if the situation is reversed and I take care of most of the financial planning, I write all the checks, I pay all the bills, I do this, I do that, and then all of a sudden my spouse is faced with the problem of handling all that, what does she do? I think at the stage of life where you find yourself, it is extremely important that if it has not already begun, you begin some sharing of those responsibilities. They're probably undesirable. You don't view it as a loving response to something, but I think it's highly important. I give you another example that in a pre-retirement conference we had, I came across an individual spouse that had never written a check, didn't know how to write a check. In this day and age, it's almost unbelievable, but it's true. It can happen, and I think some sharing in some way is highly important, particularly at this stage in life. If you're not involved, someplace, somewhere, you're going to be involved. And I think that is extremely important. It's part of your corporate planning. If you do not at this time have an extremely good budget system, I think that would be an important place to begin some of your corporate planning. This afternoon, if you have some free time, you're walking around, talk about it, think about it. Make a commitment, one spouse to the other, to begin some form of, quote, corporate planning, end of quote, within your life, so that there is a sharing between each of you relative to those particular matters. Let me get into some matters that I think probably are going to be of concern to you over the next few years. Let's talk first about housing. Some of you may very well be purchasing your own homes. Others may be living in parsonages that are furnished by the congregation. And if I gather the needs correctly and speaking to individuals about that, there's a high degree of need to purchase a home. I'm not so sure that that's the best financial decision that you can make at perhaps the point when you retire. Now, I said perhaps, and I'm going to hedge a lot here, because the point that I want to make is I think there's a lot of need to have a house because you've not had one. And I understand that need. Conversely, you look at many individuals that have retired, and true, the vast majority stay in the home where they were prior to retirement. That has been the fact and probably will remain a fact. But a lot of individuals move out of a home and into apartment upon retirement also to allow some freedom, to give them a chance to move, to not have some responsibilities that they may or may not enjoy or may not be able to do. can't take care of the yard, et cetera, et cetera. On the other hand, that may totally be your outlet too. The point I'm making is, if you make a decision about housing, do just that. At least look at all the alternatives. Bear with me for a minute in looking at just one situation. Let's say that you've been in a parsonage that's been furnished, and you've been accumulating funds to purchase a house at retirement. I would want you to at least consider an alternative to that in this way. Let's just say, you know, pick a figure. I think maybe Dr. Schultz's $500 for a tent was a little high, but I heard on the way down to the office this morning that the average home purchased in the United States today is worth $60,400. Maybe I shouldn't say the average, that's the median, the middle of the range. That's a lot of money. But let's just say, okay, let's take, you've accumulated $40,000 and you have that available to purchase a house. That may be idealistic, but at least bear with me in the example. You also are going to be paying taxes on that house. And let's say that they run somewhere $900 a year. You also are going to have upkeep, and I just made an easy example for myself. Let's say that that's $1,200 a year. Also, you're going to have to pay insurance on the house, and that's about $300 a year. All total, that comes up to $6,000. I'm sorry, the $40,000, let's say that you can invest at 9% interest today. You take that interest of $3,600, the $900 taxes, the $1,200 upkeep, the $300 insurance, comes up to a total of $6,000. If you divide that by 12 to get a monthly figure, we're talking about $500 a month. My point is, at least look at alternatives. Might that be a better alternative? You might be able to rent a house for $300, or an apartment, or a condominium, or whatever. Do what you want to do, be free, not be saddled with the house, and I'm taking some negative aspects to make my point, and do that for the $300 that you can have in interest on the money that you've accumulated, and save the other $200 a month, or at least not have that outlay relative to the house. The only point I'm making is that make a decision. Don't just blindly go and say, I've got to have a house. That may be the end result. You may very well need to meet the psychological aspects of your needing a house, and that may be the most important thing that you have to do. If that's true, fine, no problem. But at least deal with all aspects relative to that particular item. It's true, housing is appreciating. If that continues, fine. You know, I know there are a lot of things to be said for owning a house. I own mine, or at least I'm buying it, and, you know, I've made that decision. But I think in too many cases, the real need to have a house because you've never had one is the only reason that you purchase one, and it may not be the best financial decision that you've made. At least look at the alternatives. Let's look at some other financial matters relative to your life program. Investments. A lot of individuals have heard, I'm sure, that you know you need to get in the stock market. That's the only hedge against inflation. If you've followed it over the past 10 years, you find that that's really not true. Matter of fact, about 10, 11, 12 years ago, we took a look at, very seriously, the matter of maybe establishing what we call a variable annuity, which means that you have a certain underlying investment program that undergirds an annuity. And you, when you start an annuity, let's say you started at $100, that if the portfolio goes up in earnings and appreciation, you pay more to the individual. If it goes down, you take a lesser amount. And the whole theory behind that was that the stock market will follow and keep ahead of inflation, and consequently, your annuity will have a built-in inflation factor and will be undergirded by the investments in that particular portfolio. Well, needless to say, inflation goes like this, and the stock market goes like that, and the concept of the variable annuity really does not have much interest at the present time. I've had a lot of association with an individual here in St. Louis in the past that is, I think, a very, very wise individual relative to his own financial fortunes and relative to pension plans and corporate matters. And he indicated to me he really doesn't feel there's a pastor and a teacher in the Missouri Synod that ought to be in the stock market. Now, that's a broad categorical statement. There are individuals who are doing it. There are individuals who realize the risks in it. There are individuals who do it for a hobby. And I really think there's some truth to that statement, though. Can we afford to take the risks that are inherent there? So the bottom line is that maybe you can do just as well, particularly in today's climate, in fixed income investments as opposed to some investments in the stock market. Along with that, if you have a need to save additional funds for retirement and want to do that at a time when the children are through school and some funds are available that were previously used for other matters, give some serious consideration to a tax-sheltered annuity. It may not be the greatest return that you can get on your dollar, but when you combine it with the tax savings that are there, you could very well be getting just as good a return through that medium as through some other medium. I'm not here to sell you any insurance or indicate where you should buy such a program. There again, check them out. There's a lot of them around, but it is a good medium for those of us that are serving the church to use, available to those in nonprofit organizations, schools, etc., and we do have a definite advantage through that particular medium. Let's take a minute and talk about the compound interest effect that I think many of us today, number one, are probably not able to take a lot of advantage of due to inflation, but at least let's don't overlook it. It appears to me in looking back that many a poor individual, if you will, that is one that didn't earn very much, really created some rather sizable fortunes through systematic, regular saving, number one, and number two, the effect of compound interest. So don't overlook just pure savings, and I can almost hear somebody saying, you know, if only I could. Yes, if only we could. But a little bit over a long period of time certainly does add up. For example, just a little arithmetic for you. If you take the number 72 and divide it by the interest rate that you're earning on some money, that will indicate to you the number of years it takes for that money to double. Let's just say 9% today. In 8 years' time, a dollar doubles. And take another 9 years or 8 years, and that also doubles. Just think about that. And I think back too that, you know, did you know someone and in times past that was just very systematic about savings, and then hear about the widow down the street that died with X thousands of dollars or hundreds of thousands of dollars of money? And I think it was really through that systematic monitoring that that kind of thing can be really accomplished. Just a word or two about life insurance. In our benefit programs, we really don't feel that we have all of the coverage that you may need. I think, to say it another way, there is room in your personal programs for some personal life insurance, and for various and sundry reasons. Untimely death, you may want to take care of college education. You may want to pay off the house. And I'm not talking about any particular form of life insurance. There's mortgage insurance, but it all is under the concept of some form of insurance payable upon your death. As you approach retirement, I think you ought to take a second look at the coverage that you've provided for yourself and ask yourself, do I still need that? Does it still go for the objective that I had when I bought it? Do I still have that in mind? You know, if you bought $20,000 and that's what you needed at a particular time, do you now, in retirement, need that amount of life insurance? You may want to leave some money to the children, and if that's the case, fine. At least know what and why you have in life insurance and what and why and how you're going to use it. You may want to look at it from this point of view. Take some paid-up insurance, have that, take care of your needs for burial and whatever else you have in mind. Take the balance of the cash value in that particular protection that you have bought and convert it to an annuity. What you've really done is three things. You have a paid up amount of insurance, you've eliminated a bill, i.e. the premium that you've been paying, and you've created income. So just to have a life policy and to just keep paying for it, just because you bought it at an early age and it was the wise thing to do, and it was, don't stop looking at those kind of items and just say, well, it's another bill. You know, I need it, I bought it, it's good. At least work through some items like that, that you can look at it, question the value of it, and also talk to your insurance agent about what are the other possibilities that I have relative to that particular item. Just recently, and by that I mean in the last few years, we've tried to provide you with a tool through our office that you can hopefully use this in your corporate planning, your family planning. I'm talking about this personal statement of benefits that's been provided to you from our office. It gives information about your current protection, which you should review with your spouse. And ladies, if you haven't seen this, will you make a contract with yourself that when you get home, make sure you go over it with your husband, that you know exactly what kinds of protection are being provided by the church, where you may see some shortages in that particular protection? Do you have other protection to take care of that? At least review all of that. Not only does it give you information about the current situation, but look at the bottom half of it dealing with your future protection. By that I mean retirement income as well as benefits after death, after retirement. Those items are included in there. Review it carefully. Do it every year. Look at one, look at the one after that to see what has changed, because changes in compensation, changes in age, all affect most of the benefits that are provided. So make sure that you review that and use it as a tool to assist you in your planning. Particularly, let's say, the retirement benefits. What we do, we take your current compensation and say that that's going to remain static for the ensuing years up to age 65. We do not build in any increases in compensation. We try to do it on that basis to give you the relationships between your current compensation and, if that remains where it is, what your benefit will be at, say, age 65, or later if you are already 65 and not retired. yes, you can at least deal with those relationships and say, okay, if that's providing 80% of my income at present as a retirement benefit, you can fairly well assume that that relationship will remain. If your compensation goes up, I think you can say, okay, 80% of my compensation will be approximately what I'm going to receive in retirement benefits. So you can look at the relationships and deal with that, even though you might say, well, you know, 5 years from now, salaries may be double if inflation keeps going or whatever they may be. And, you know, what good is this dollar amount? Agreed. But at least deal with the relationship. Thank you. It was a good question. Yes. No, they have not. And that's a point that I'll talk about, too. Let's do it right now. Let me just make a couple more comments, and then let's get into a good question and answer period, because according to my watch, the ladies are going to have to leave in just about a couple minutes. One other point relative to health care coverage. Be aware, as you approach age 65, you have certain responsibilities relative to Medicare coverage. You do have to go to the Medicare office during the 3 months prior to the month in which you attain age 65. You need to sign up. You don't need to sign up for Part A of Medicare, which is the hospital coverage that's provided automatically, but you do need to sign up for Part B of Medicare and unfortunately begin paying premiums for that also. So make sure that you take care of that and know that your coverage changes under our plans when you attain age 65. One big change that's true right now, and you may be late, you may be right on the verge of this, or you may be at least in a position to do a little planning. We do not provide dental coverage after age 65 through the Concordia Welfare Plan. Nor does Medicare provide dental coverage. So if you're under age 65, and let me first say, the coverage stops on the first of the month during which you attain age 65, not on your birthday, the first of the month. So if you're under age 65, I think I've given you fair warning. Or to put it positively, if you didn't hear me, do take care of your dental needs prior to age 65 and prior to the first of the month during which you attain age 65. Don't lose sight of that fact. And also be aware that I said right now, we really are looking at that whole concept. We did what we did for some very good reasons, and maybe we can get to that in the question and answer period. But at least at the present, that's where we are, and be aware of that. Let me also encourage you that if you get the chance, whether it's an upcoming program that will be available through the Growth and Ministry Program, where they're in the final stages of testing some pre-retirement conferences that will be held around the country for pastors, or whether it's through a SMART program, which is the one available from AAL, or whether it's through your local college or wherever it may be, if you see the opportunity, don't pass it up to be a part of a pre-retirement conference. I think most of them are designed along some rather standard lines. They cover many, many other subjects beyond what I dealt with just with a little brush today, and I think you'd find it very rewarding in areas of housing, health, et cetera, so forth, just all sorts of particular topics that are extremely good to review, particularly prior to retirement. As I said earlier, while you're here at the seminary, if you brought your spouse, take the time to at least talk about some of the things that you really haven't dealt with previously. You know, where are certain papers? Do you need to take care of that? Can I have a part in that? What happens if I have to do that next month? Next year. Look at some of those aspects of what I call corporate planning and see whether you can't turn around a little bit of that feeling that, you know, it's just something I don't have time for. She takes care of it. He takes care of it. I don't need to worry about it. Some of those kind of responses to what we said earlier, loving responses. If you do that, I'll feel better about it, and I know you'll feel better about it too. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Earl. This time we will excuse the ladies, and the reason that time was moved up is that the Guild has hired somebody to entertain you, I think, in an educational fashion that you'll enjoy, and they had to come at 9:30. So, and if the gentlemen will remain, we'll take our coffee break after the question and answer period. Fine. Let's wait until things settle down a minute.
Yes, right here.